We take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Ben.
And tonight we are looking at the season or series 2, episode 2 of Blake 7, entitled Shadow by Chris Boucher. Blake has a new strategy for fighting the Federation, a strategy that doesn't meet with the approval of all his crew. He plans to buy the support of the Terra Nostra, the Galactic Mafia, and use their resources to support his rebellion. Arriving at Space City, their home territory, Blake tries to contact Largo, an old associate of Jenna's. Largo tried to get Jenna to smuggle Shadow, the most dangerous drug in the galaxy. When she refused, she was soon picked up by the authorities. Blake tries to negotiate, but Largo gets the drop on them and prepares to turn them in for the reward. On board the Liberator, Villa, desperate to visit Space City, gets Orak to teleport him over against Blake's orders. In exchange, he hides Orak from the others. Callie rescues everyone, but then succumbs to a psychic attack from Orak. Blake uses Zen to analyze a sample of Shadow and discovers its planet of origin. They set course for the planet in an effort to deal with the Terra Nostra from a position of strength. While Blake, Avon, and Jenna discover the awful truth about Shadow and the Terra Nostra, Orak tries to destroy the Liberator. Only Callie and some surprise allies can save the day. Orak had been possessed by an alien using his carrier waves as a bridge from another dimension. Avon takes steps to prevent that from ever happening again. So this is a bit of a first for Blake 7.
In what way?
First episode not written by Terry Nation.
That's true, yeah. That could explain a few things.
It is a little different, actually.
It is. It is.
And not in a bad way.
Not necessarily in a bad way, but there was a number of elements to the story that sort of, I don't want to say they stuck out, but they stuck out.
Such as?
Blake's characterization in this episode is a bit gruffer than I remember. He's really almost a little antagonistic towards everybody else on the ship, especially when it comes to his plan to meet with the Terra Nostra. And even though some people are trying to talk him out of it, I mean, he's really hell-bent on it. And he's almost... God, I don't quite know how to explain it, but it felt that the more people were trying to tell Blake not to go down that road, the more he was going to stamp his feet and say, I'm going to go down that road.
We have discussed the character of Blake and how he seems to be, how do I put this?
Well, he's not entirely consistent.
He's not entirely consistent, and he's also not entirely the good guy.
No.
He has been at times a good guy, and then at other times he's blown people up without, you know, even giving them a chance not to die. And I think we're seeing, it's pretty early in the second season, but I think we're seeing Blake's getting a little desperate.
Could this be, in terms of Blake's characterization, could this be a reflection of Chris Boucher's writing?
I think a little of it may be, although he has not exactly... I looked over his credits. The people listening to this show will probably know his name from Doctor Who, where in 1977, I think it was all in 77, he wrote The Face of Evil, The Robots of Death, and The Image of the Fendal.
None of my favorite episodes.
I always kind of liked Image of the Fendal.
Not too crazy, but I sort of like Robots of Death, but...
But there's nothing particularly gruff or more out of character. I mean, so in other words, he's not writing the Doctor as a different character. So we could assume that he's not intentionally writing the Blake out of character, or that this is some bugaboo that he always has to do.
Well, we'll say this about Chris's writing and the way he's characterizing the crew of the Liberator. This was the most proactive I've ever seen Gan be throughout the entire series.
Still useless, but at least.
But not proactive. Entirely. I did not find him entirely useless in this episode.
Well, Gan has brought a little bit of morality to the story too. Instead of being the waste, he was the guy that says, "Hey, you know, the Terra Nostra is bad."
He was the moral backbone. And even at one point, when Blake, he's issuing an order, you know, telling Gan to monitor what Liberator's doing, and Blake's saying, and Gan looks at him and says, I'm watching. There's nothing, you know, what do you want me to do? You know, and it's the first time I've ever seen Gan actually, he's not necessarily standing up to Blake, but he's standing up. And he's making himself counted. You know, he counts as one of the crew instead of just this person who has been largely ineffective throughout the entire series.
Yes. And another thing that I think is really noticeable. One of the things that Blake Seven is known for is the snarky dialogue between the characters. It was up a level on this episode.
Yes, it was.
And it was good. I mean, it was good snarky. These are some of those lines that you get out of character, particularly Avon, that are the ones that people remember. I mean, the one where Gan is talking about how they were looking for Orak. Orak wants to be hidden, and Gan comes back and he says, "I tried looking all over the section. I even tried calling out his name." And Avon just turning on him and saying, "Oh, I wish I'd seen that. That's the kind of natural stupidity that's impossible to duplicate," or whatever it was that he said. I mean, those are the lines that people remember from Blake Seven. I think the first time I ever saw an episode guide of Blake Seven, they tried to spin it, and they said, you know, Blake Seven's not a show so much about the plot as it is about the characterization dynamics between the people. And so that was what they emphasized, was all these lines that
kicked back and forth. I mean, I don't know if that was what Terry's initial idea was, but I believe that that is what the series that was its strength. I'm not going to say that was its purpose or its focus, but that is the one thing that I think everybody always comes back to. I mean, yes, the stories largely were pretty good. They're very enjoyable for their time. You've got an interesting overall reaching story arc, if you want to call it that. But what is it that everybody remembers? It's the personalities and the way they interacted with each other.
Mm-hmm. And this is why I'm not too concerned about Blake's gruff characterization, because I think we have seen the seeds of this, that Blake has his hero's morality, but beating the Federation is more important to him than his standards.
True, but I think
it was just more obvious in this one, because the plot of the story is, hey, we're going to go meet up with terrible people, and we're going to do a deal with these terrible people. So, I mean, it just shows
he's at a point where the ends justify the means. But I kind of get the feeling that maybe we have seen that before. Maybe you're right. Maybe this is Blake becoming desperate. But the whole desperation aspect of it seems a little bit – to me, it seemed a little bit out of the blue.
Here's a – and I, you know, can't say that we're going to go down this path necessarily, but many – Many of the revolutionary heroes throughout history, particularly in modern times, have all followed this path of, we're fighting for what's right, we're fighting for justice for our people, and they move to, we're fighting in dirty ways, if there is such a thing as fighting in dirty ways. You can look at Cuba and people like Che Guevara, and by the time they come to the end of their run, they're pretty darn nasty.
Oh, I don't. I'm not disagreeing with you on that. I agree completely. I just thought that this is
what terrorists are made from,
right? Exactly. And I don't disagree. And I could see that becoming Blake's being the path that Blake is on. It just felt that he got to this point a little fast.
It could be. And who knows,
I mean, I would have liked to have seen maybe a more intermediate step or more of a process before he got to this level. And he's not fully there yet either. I mean, I know that, but at this still, it felt like to. I mean, we've seen him take on the attitude of the ends justify the means several times, but this one felt really
this is pretty strong. One, not in the moment. In the past, his ends justify the means have been in the moment.
Right. This one was premeditated. Was
that's right.
It was very premeditated and drastic enough that it made everybody else a little bit squeamish.
But wouldn't it be cool if that's the route they take, that they start looking at Blake and instead of the stand-up hero guy, they work their way towards somebody who perhaps you couldn't necessarily recommend as a hero. Hmm. You know? I mean, you can always recommend Captain Kirk. He's a good guy from beginning to end, even when
he's a Boy Scout.
But Raj Blake is not. And Raj Blake clearly has the ability to go down a dark path if that's what it takes for his, and let's call it what it is, it's a crusade. It's an obsession.
Yeah.
It's not just about freeing the people. It's about getting back at the Federation for what they did to him, for what they did to his family, what they did to his memories, what they did to his reputation, all of it. I mean,
oh, they hurt him. They hurt him badly, and he wants to hurt them back.
Yes. So,
and this episode shows that quite clearly.
And it's not necessarily a bad strategy. I mean, I don't know how much money they have on the Liberator, but we know it's a lot. And so, you know, why not use the money? I mean, it's not like you're afraid of breaking the law.
True. I agree with all of that. Like I said, there was some tone to some of the things that Blake was saying that made me think that he had moved into an area or he had I don't know how to put this. It's driving me crazy. But he just moved into this area that was very almost unfamiliar because of the intensity.
Even Avon pointed it out.
Yeah.
Lawmakers, lawbreakers, let us fight them all then at one point. You know, he's clearly seeing, and it's funny because there's a point where Blake kind of, Avon challenges him and Blake gives him a sort of, I wouldn't say an out, but do you disagree? And Avon doesn't disagree. He, unlike Gan clearly disagrees. Avon sees it for the pragmatic action that it is, but it isn't what he would do.
No.
It's a...
Well, that's probably because Avon has different goals, which is why it's not a step he would take.
And I'd say laying low is part of it. Avon's still somehow vested in this in a bigger way. I don't know if he's so needs to destroy the Federation like Blake does, but clearly I think he thinks maybe Blake can do it.
He might think that. I think also right now Avon is considering his, you know, he's been considering his options and thinks that at the present time, sticking it out with Blake and Liberator is the best option for him. I mean, we know that there was an episode last season where he had the choice to leave the ship and was going to make it. And then the circumstances just weren't playing out the way he wanted them to. And he looked at the situation and thought, this is not a good place for me to be. I'm better off on the ship.
I wonder how much of this change is a function of Chris Boucher or is a function of it being series two and that perhaps even, you know, put it back to Terry Nation, that he has a plan, a story arc, if you will.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's a good point. I mean, because
we had to deal with redemption.
We had a cliffhanger that we had to resolve. So now is the first real launching point episode of season two, very early on. So yeah, maybe it is a combination of several things. It could be the fact that this is season two. Terry was already thinking about maybe a new, not necessarily a new direction, but a new approach, a new way of telling the story through the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that this is episode two, and now you've got someone else who's written it. It could be all these things coming together to give the episode its different tone through its characters.
Here's something else about this episode, and it's partially true in Redemption as well. It's clear they've got a new costume designer.
Oh, yeah.
And I think they probably have a new set designer, or maybe it still falls down to the costume designer. But the Space City, the Terra Nostra people, the Dream Heads with their funky skin tones and stuff. It just, it has a different feel than what it has had in the past. And I can't say I like it. I don't like the changes to the style that we've had so far.
It feels a bit hip.
Yes. Okay. Yes,
that's what I get. That's what I get.
Part of its time. It feels more dated than it does. Than the first batch did.
Yeah, especially with the costuming.
The utilitarian feel. The first series had a sort of, well, you know, the clothes that Blake wore. They may have had a style that's not modern, but they just sort of had a functional feel to them. I threw some stuff on, but these with the puffy sleeves and the cape that Gan was wearing last time, and I mean, yeah. It's like, okay, now we've gone for flourish over function.
Exactly, and I think you used the word utilitarian. I would say that in the first season, given the nature of the Federation and the kind of government that it was and how oppressive it was, I would say that the costumes were more totalitarian. So everything was kind of subdued and everything was kind of equal.
Except for Servalyn,
of course.
But
you have to make her different.
Right.
She's got to stand out. But with everybody else, it was kind of very, very low key. And it wasn't until, I think, a little bit later when Jenna is going through the cupboards, Han Liberator, and discover some new costuming. But yes, when we got into season two, we started seeing a change in the outfits. And to me, I noticed it as well. And I thought, wow, everybody's all of a sudden looking a bit hip.
And considering what Jenna was wearing in the first series, which had a certain Farrah Fawcett sort of pastel flair to it at times, you'd think that would be more dated, but it isn't.
No, actually what they're doing now feels more dated, and I agree with you. I don't exactly care for it because I think in season one, at least the way they were being the way the wardrobe was being handled, it almost gave it a timelessness to it, in that you could drop it in any era. And yeah, I mean, the show's going to be dated no matter what. We can't escape that, but not to the point of where it takes away from the viewing experience. When I watch season two, I'm yanked out of the episode of what the story is trying to tell me, because all of a sudden these costumes are now staring at me in the face, and that's now it's a distraction, and I don't care for that.
I'll survive it, but
I don't like it. And especially when they beamed down to the planet and. They were wearing, I guess, it was supposed to be some sort of, I don't know, some sort of costume, you know, to help deal with the intensely hot weather and the binary suns. But at the same time, it never looked functional.
Yeah, you know, that was the one costume that didn't bother me so much, but only because it looked like it was supposed to be functional. I mean, I know it as desert dwellers. That probably would not actually be the most functional piece of clothing that you could wear onto a blisteringly hot, broad daylight day if you didn't want sunburn. But just like in last series where they had those cold suits that had the dial controls on them, I was kind of giving that a pass and going, you know, I bet those are actually technology suits of some kind.
Yeah, the thought had occurred to me.
Otherwise, they wouldn't have all put on the same jumpsuit.
But and you're right. I had that thought too, but I kept thinking that, wow, it looks like they're wearing gauze.
A little bit of dialogue would have helped. You know, a little bit of dialogue somewhere in a scene where they said they were putting on their, you know, heat repellent electric suits or something.
Or at least some kind of warning from Blake or Avon saying,
on the dial,
now make sure you do this with your suit and you know it'll help you last on the planet a little bit longer.
Which is exactly what they did with the cold suits there in one episode. It suits up, dial up, and Villa's like, oh, turn mine up to 11. And then he's burning out. So
yeah.
You got to feel for
Instead, this time I felt like I was looking at people just dressed in gauze, loose-fitting gauze for that matter.
Sort of a G. They had a little black belt and
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So we have the subplot, if you will, of Villa desperately trying to get
over to
Space City.
Oh, that's like the sub-subplot.
That's the sub-subplot. Yeah, that's a bit of a sub-subplot. The satellite of Sin, place he's wanted to go to ever since he was old enough to be a juvenile delinquent.
Yeah.
What was he doing over there?
Drinking, apparently.
Is that what it was?
Yeah, because he comes back with a hangover from hell.
He does come back from a hangover, but when Callie calls him and he's, oh, yes, Callie.
Yeah, that was weird.
Oh, the sights I've seen. You should see the sights I've seen. No, no, you shouldn't. It's like, I could not figure out what he was doing. Was he having sex with strange things, or was he hallucinating?
I thought he was mind controlled, to be honest.
It didn't sound like him.
No.
I mean, that was supposed to be drunk acting.
That wasn't very good.
It was terrible drunk acting.
And
I don't think that's what it was. I think he was... I'm not sure what he was supposed to do.
I think he was supposed to create a sense of complete awe and wonder. I mean, this is his first time that he's actually experiencing the satellite of Sin. So maybe the actor was trying to really... present us, the viewer, that Villa is just completely overwhelmed by this place of his fantasies. But it didn't come off. It came out very, very badly, because I'm sure everybody else who watched it for the first time was thinking the same thing that we were. Like, what the heck is going on with this guy?
Yeah.
And then they really don't even explore that part of the story any further.
Because the next time, back?
Well, no. The next time we see him, he's already back and he has a hangover. I thought that was the worst hand wave.
Yeah, because he'd taken his bracelet off. So how did they beam him back?
Yeah, I know. It was very disappointing.
Yeah,
and it was a waste of a storyline.
But he did have the line before he got over there, is when he stuck the key in on Orak, and he's like, "Orak, are you in there?"
Yeah. Where else would I be?
What do you think I am? Some sort of a rat in a cage?
Cage, yeah. Yet another wonderful line from Orak.
Yes. And then the other subplot is, of course,
this was weird.
The alien
consciousness that was trying to
out and take over the universe.
Yeah, that was just bizarre. And how that was supposed to sort of tie in using Callie. You know, we have to use Callie as the victim again.
Hey, but wait a minute. But they used Callie to good effect. Remember, she's
that's
a telepath.
True.
They actually
did good stuff with her this time. I will admit, I love that she was able to beam a message over to Blake.
But she's the hero of this piece.
In a way, yeah, she is.
From across the board. I mean, she saves them in the end because of her strength and because of the help of the moon discs.
Yeah.
And she saves Blake and the crew when they get captured by the Terra Nostra. Callie does all right in this episode, and she uses her telepathy, which is grossly underwritten in this show. But I was pleased. Frankly, I liked Callie.
I liked her in this.
I don't know
but
why.
It kind of bothered
Callie better than Jenna. I mean, I don't think she's as classically good looking.
She's not. Jenna's gorgeous.
And she's a bit of a, I don't know, at least Jenna seems to be the one that's supposed to be sort of the hardened pirate. And Callie's supposed to be the
Callie was the tough one.
But Callie is the tough one.
Because she's the freedom fighter, too.
And she also can hold her own a little bit better in a way that it just doesn't come off right with Jenna. So I've always liked her better in the show. So I'm pleased when she gets a chance to actually do something, although she didn't get to beat up Villa.
That would have been fun to watch. But her story in terms of the way they were trying to use it, I don't know, it felt like they were creating two different tones. There's the one tone of story that's involving Blake and the Terra Nostra and the Shadow, and then there's this whole different tone of story with Callie and the subplot that she's involved in. I mean, that was almost Twilight Zone-ish.
Hey, let me ask you this question, because I didn't really think about it. But we have repeatedly pointed out, if not complained, of the A-plot, B-plot, Terry Nation story here we have an A-plot, B-plot story, and it did not feel, even though they are sort of disconnected stories, it didn't feel as disconnected to me as, you know, say, Time Squad or, you know, I can't think of a, the first part of the two-parter in at the end of the series or any of those ones where they just had the story on the ship. Oh, we've got the President Zarkov and the pirates stories. These two melded together better, even though they weren't the same story, and I don't know why. It could just be Chris Boucher's writing style.
That's an interesting point. And I got to think about that.
They are totally independent.
Well, they are independent, even though they do play together, the two storylines, because as
I think
you
they
stated,
come to a head better.
They do.
Together.
They do very
That's
easily.
That's what it is. They
yes,
both
they,
come
they
to
very much come together at the end, and I think that by the time you get to the end of the episode, when you see how the whole thing works together, you're able to look at the earlier part of the episode and forgive it for any kind of head scratching it may have caused. But I kept thinking about just the tone of her storyline and the tone of Blake's storyline and how they are night and day.
That's true.
They're very, very different, even though, yes, they do come together in some kind of convergence.
Yeah, they are. They so are a different style.
Yes, very, very different style. So as far as an A-plot, B-plot kind of thing goes, I have to give that one some thought. I don't know if I was being very much reminded of the whole A-plot, B-plot scenario, more so with this than with any other. I really don't know yet. I have to give this – this is one of these episodes that I have to give a lot of thought about.
Well, that's a good thing sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, this it's, you know, not like last week's, you know, where it was just a simple, you know, okay, well, Rescue the Liberator. I mean, that was a popcorn episode. This one is not. There's a lot to look at here.
There's a lot to look at here because of the themes of Blake and his crusade and
the things that we learn as well about who
the Federation and the Terra Nostra, one and the same.
They're working together.
Two sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
And of course that's hardly surprising in a way. I mean I didn't see it coming. Of course, we didn't see it coming because the Terra Nostra has never been mentioned before prior to this episode, which is one of the bad things.
Yeah, that's something I'm not a big fan of.
If the Terra Nostra had been – if even that term had been used as the Mafia along in the past, if you know, and certainly Jenna could have used it in places to talk about things that had happened, you know, even if it was just, you know, in passing, then – that would have been a lot better when the day came when Blake said, "Let's go talk to the Terra Nostra."
Exactly. Instead of just throwing it out of the blue like it was in this one.
However, on the flip side, the Terra Nostra is such an obvious play on the Mafia, and the Mafia is so deeply ingrained in the cultural myth of crime and in our culture that it does write in nicely. You know, they go, "Oh, there's a Mafia. Why should I not be surprised?"
Yeah,
you know, it does add a whole thing. It's like, I'll bet there's prostitution in this universe, and I'll bet there's drug smuggling in this universe. And, you know, it does open up a whole thing. You go, "Oh, yeah, well, you know, we just have never bumped into it, but that makes perfect sense."
And to a lot of people, the Terra Nostra is a myth. So that you could also possibly use that story element to
like the mafia,
justify.
They are a myth. They do not exist.
They do not exist in order to justify why they were never brought up before.
Mm-hmm. So it's, I just the fact that we bring them up and in the same episode we find out that they are one and the same. I would have loved it if we had
gone several episodes in further and then discovered that would have been more enjoyable.
And I'm unclear on the resolution of this episode. Did Blake wipe out all the shadow or just that production facility?
I think just that production, because he tells the one Dreamhead.
He tells the Dreamhead who's not a Dreamhead. Yeah,
right. He tells him. He said, "This will not. This will not." I think he says this will sting him.
This will sting him a lot. Yeah, it won't destroy him.
It will not destroy him, but this will sting him.
Yeah.
So this
president of the Federation.
Right. So it's not like It's not like he was completely, totally eradicating all production of spice. Oh, I'm sorry. I was thinking of Dune there for a second.
Well, spice has that
because there's. Well, I mean, but there's a little bit of similarity there too. I mean, because I think even Blake says that, and if they can control the production of shadow, then they control the Terra Nostra.
Okay, I'll go along with that. The other piece of it that's Dune-ish is the fact that the spice only comes from Arrakis.
Yeah.
And nobody knows exactly where it comes from, and it turns out it comes from an animal or a thing that lives there, as I recall, right?
It was the sandworms,
right? You do something to a sandworm and it becomes
when they die and decay, I think is their bodies then turn into spice.
So this is the moon discs that are native only to that planet, and so yeah, that is a bit of a Dune-ish ripoff, even down to the heat of the planet,
right? And Blake I don't know if it's a direct quote from the book, but it's. Or maybe David Lynch quoted it when he did his movie Dune. Maybe he borrowed it from Blake Seven. I don't know. But, you know, if he who controls the spice controls the universe, and Blake almost says the same thing. I mean, he says, you know, if we can control the shadow, we can control the Terra Nostra.
Yeah, he wasn't thinking big enough, but yeah.
No, but he was thinking about just getting the Terra Nostra to work for him. And by controlling, because shadow is that's their big export. That's their big industry. That's where all their money is tied into.
Would it really work? I mean, could he keep an organization like the Terra Nostra in check with one spacecraft, no matter how good it is?
I don't think so.
I don't either.
No, especially after he learns that the Terra Nostra are in bed with the Federation, forget it.
Yeah, no, at that point, no. He hasn't been able to defeat Travis, who has come close to defeating him more than once.
Yeah.
If it hadn't been for luck on Blake's side. So he couldn't defend a planet.
Oh.
He couldn't. They'd have to take up a planetary position, hold it, and then that would be the end of it. And eventually they'd have to leave, and when they left, they'd have the shadow back. So, yeah.
I mean, the only thing that Blake could hope to do would be to try to destroy the planet. But I don't know if that's the direction that Blake would be willing to go down. Well, maybe. Actually, maybe. Yeah, you know, I take that back. Clearly, he is showing that the ends justify the means. And yeah, if he got desperate enough, yes, I think he would try to blow that planet up. But would it be effective in damaging the Terra Nostra to the point of almost eliminating them? I don't think so.
Yeah, I mean, plenty of other vices you can cater to.
Exactly. I mean, like any illegal organization that's involved in racketeering and that kind of work, I would imagine that they're more diversified than it appears. I mean, yes, they have the one big industry being shadow in this particular case, but I would imagine that they probably have several other little interests that help keep them afloat.
Isn't it interesting how much of a product of its time this is, though? I mean, if my understanding is correct, there is a growing problem, working on the assumption that you are one of the people that is in the side of the belief that drugs are a problem for society and people as a whole, in that our laws cannot keep up with the designer drugs that they are now able to produce from, you know, either variants of existing drugs or through other means. And so the laws can't keep up with the production. So to go back to a model of drug production that's like, well, if we had the poppy fields, we could get rid of the heroin.
Right.
Right? Which is basically what they're saying here. If you could, if we blew this planet up, you couldn't grow moon discs anywhere else, and that would be the end of the drug. But you know that even with, you know, even in the advances we've made since Blake Seven aired, that by the time they get into the future, that just is not, that's not a believable position.
No.
But then probably neither is Spice and Dune, and that's one of the greatest works of science fiction of all time. So, mm-hmm. Also dated.
Quite.
So, I liked, maybe not the execution, but I liked the idea of the moon discs.
Yeah, it was interesting. It was novel.
An alien cactus Like, I don't know why they call it a cactus.
No, it doesn't look like a cactus in the slightest.
Well, I don't know what cactus looks like.
Well, I don't know. Okay, and they start talking about an alien cactus, and the first thought that ran through my head is
Megalos.
Ooh, Megalos.
But a plant that can move to find shade because of the conditions. I mean, that's an interesting sci-fi concept. You know, if there are plants, how would we do this? It's like, okay, yeah, all right. That's a little different. Oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
The execution was a little strange, but.
Yeah. I can
probably cheap.
Yeah, I'm exactly. I can give that one a bit of a pass. I mean, I thought it was a little odd, but it didn't take me out of the story, so I was able to let it go. I like the idea that the moon discs were telepathic. I found that interesting, and as Callie pointed, I think it was Callie, it was Jenna. Who pointed out that they were whispering to each other.
Yeah.
So I find the concept of the moon discs even more interesting now. And I don't believe that at any point we're ever going to be exploring the moon discs again. I don't see any reason why we should. But it would
have – Callie's got one on the ship.
Yeah, that's true. But I don't think that's really going to play much of a role anymore.
Callie's Pally.
Hmm. I got nothing. I just trying to understand the organization of the moon discs, and are we talking about some form of plant life that has some level of sentience? They must, because they helped break through to Callie and help her realize that she wasn't isolated. That like the alien being that was trying to beam through Orak was trying to convince her to be. I mean that was. It was using her the idea of isolation as a means of capturing her, of completely immobilizing her, and then the moon discs were able to give her the strength to break through that. So it makes me wonder, about the nature of the moon discs. I mean, it's an irrelevant story idea when you look at the overall series, but it was, and in a way, this is maybe a good thing, but they were just interesting enough for this episode to make me say, gee, I kind of like to learn more about them.
Yeah, we could go on probably for a long time trying to analyze the concept of a telepathic plant. Do you have to be sentient to be telepathic?
Mm.
And I'm not sure that that's a true statement. I mean, a dog thinks and a dog obviously reacts. So if Pavlov's dog hears a bell and he starts to drool, then he is thinking, but he is not sentient.
It's not sentient like people.
But if Pavlov's dog hears a bell and he starts to drool and he can project into his thought to the mind of another dog and causes that dog to drool, then he is a telepathic dog.
And all of this, of course, is moot since telepathy doesn't really exist. So
it's in the Blake 7 universe.
But this is one of these questions that's kind of hard to.
How many angels can fit in the head of a pin?
Right, yeah. That kind of thing. I mean, there's nothing that we can actually use to test it.
Oh, that's true. Oh, that's absolutely true. It's just interesting thought exercise.
Oh, it is. I mean, it's a lot. It's another one of these things that's kind of fun to ponder.
So she's hearing thoughts. She has the fellowship of these creatures in her mind. That is what alleviates her loneliness. They don't have to be intelligent. She could be in a pack of dogs, right? I mean, if you're lonely and you have a dog, you're not as lonely, even though they are not.
They're not people.
They're not people.
But exactly, and she was. So she was in the presence of. She was in the presence of other life. She was not isolated. The moonstones are telepathic, they were able to help break through the barrier that had been placed in her mind.
Now, here's one thing that in this episode that I did not get the first 10 times I watched it.
Oh dear.
It's a small thing. I thought at the end of this episode that Avon had seriously crippled Orak, because in the original remit, and Orak hasn't been around for long, but he's already stopped predicting the future.
Right.
as far as we can tell.
Yay.
Ensor said that he had powerful carrier waves that could penetrate through to any computer and then communicate with it if it had terial cells in it.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought that what Aven had done at the end of this episode was he planted a bomb that if Orak used those carrier waves, he would explode, and therefore limiting Orak's capabilities of tapping to computers that are nearby, as opposed to everywhere, which is what was kind of implied beforehand, is that he had access to everything everywhere. But that's not what Aven says in this. He actually says if someone tries to use Orak's carrier waves beyond their whatever, then that's what causes it. So I guess Orak has not been impaired, and I always thought that he had. I thought they were, frankly, I thought they were reining in his powers.
I thought they were practically giving him a lobotomy.
Yeah.
Basically, I mean, and that's kind of the impression that I got. And this is only, I mean, I have not seen this episode before. This was actually the first time I've seen this one, at least that I remember. So, yeah, I thought that Aven had actually done something to limit and inhibit some of Orak's ability. So, I thought the same thing that you did the first 10 times you saw it.
So, would an alien being trying to use Orak to come through know that there'd been a bomb placed at the other end and not come through and thereby avoiding the explosion? Or would it not know, try to force its way through, boom, end of Orak, which seems like a terrible waste?
That's a really good question. And sadly, I think this is another one of these story ideas that does not get explored ever again, so we never get to find out exactly how that scenario would have played out.
That I'm... I think you're right, but I'm not going to swear to it, and therefore I'm not going to spoiler it and say that it's a definite no. It might be. I don't remember. It seems like there's something else that comes out of it that played along with my thought that they couldn't use Orak at his full capabilities, but what they really need is they need some way to stop him from predicting the future. That's a terrible curse to have in script writing.
Well, it was a great plot idea, especially when it comes to the end of the first season. I mean,
I can see the future.
I can see the future. This is a big thing that the Federation's clearly going to want to get their hands on. Servalon's going to want it because she now has this very powerful little computer that could help her rule the universe.
So Blake now possesses the most advanced starship in existence, which was created by a group of people who have been blown up and don't exist anymore, so it is unique. Mm-hmm. And he has the most advanced computer system in the entire universe, and its creator is dead, and it is completely unique and cannot be recreated. How can he lose?
You would think that by this point he'd be unstoppable.
I would think that Orak could absolutely cripple the Federation.
Totally cripple the Federation.
It's like, Orak, take out all their computers. Just all of them. Shut them down. Everything. Send bad data. Ruin them.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure, I wouldn't be surprised if Terry were alive and you asked him, why didn't you have Orak do this? I'm sure Terry would say, oh, well, between episodes this and that, Blake actually did approach Orak to do that, and Orak said that he was busy. Yeah. Exactly.
Anyway. All right. I don't know that I have anything else on this particular episode. It was, like I said, I thought the dialogue-wise, it was much better. I thought design-wise, it was much poorer.
Mm-hmm.
Structure of story, better. Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead. I was going to say, I really like the way a lot of the characters were used, a lot of the Liberator crew were used, except for Villa. I mean, I had started to like him from the last third of last year up until last week. I was really beginning to enjoy him, and then then we get to this one, and I was immediately reminded of why I thought he was such a sniveling weasel. But aside from him, I really liked the way everybody else was. I mean, Blake, initially I had problems with Blake, but you know, after we've talked about it, I've come to actually sort of get a better grip as to why he's behaving the way he's behaving. And I thought everybody else was just really in top form. I mean, Callie was very strong in this. Gan, this was the best I've ever seen Gan, mm-hmm. in all honesty. He's never been this good. Avon is always great. So this was – yeah, I think this was a very enjoyable episode.
Yeah, well, I guess we'll find out. We'll find out if the theme with Blake continues on,
and if we ever see the Terra Nostra again.
That's right. We've put paid to the Terra Nostra. Next time when we talk about Blake 7, we will be looking at the episode entitled "Weapon," written by Chris Boucher.
Hey, this is going to be interesting.
Two in a row.
Yeah. I mean, we can do a little bit of a contrast and comparison now.
So world building. So man,
I don't have a problem with that. I mean, if he can write something of the same kind of quality that we got here, then I only see this season becoming more and more positive.
All right. Well, Ben, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
And listeners, I hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol.
Confirmed.
Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us, leave us a review on iTunes, or stop by and visit at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, search for Fusion Patrol, or just drop us a note at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolfe.